Jason Finado, the music of Discord, the theme music for a monthly book program about serious publishing, serious books, and the great problems which they are facing in the modern world. I am Hans Koning. I've had a series of guests so far. We have had some great names and some names deserving to be great. Today we have Art Winslow, who is the literary editor of The Nation and also was formerly an editor of the magazine. His entire past is interwoven with books. All his jobs were connected with books. He was the president of a book critics circle at one point, and he is an excellent person to throw his light on what's going on in the world of books. We begin by asking him his reaction to a small segment from a conversation I had last month with Anthony Scheer, the British literary agent, and who spoke some rather funny words, it seemed to me, about great bookstores.
How bad the big bookstores are. They tend to look wonderful because they have so many books and they have so many floors and everything looks very exciting. When you actually get in there, it's amazing what they don't have. It's amazing how boring what they do have. And it's amazing how little the staff know about what they have.
Well, this was, we played this here, and for a prominent large bookstore executive, and he got terribly upset. And of course, I invited him to counteract this, and I told him that I certainly didn't completely agree with it because I have very nice experiences with the big bookstores. They really give people a chance to do as many readings almost as they want. But he got very upset. He didn't quite catch on, or he was very intimidated by his super boss, and he walked out. He said that I was trying to ruin his career. But I trust that you have no such reservations, and I invite you to comment on it.
Well, I think what he says has a great deal of validity. What you have to remember is that you're not seeing, if you walk into, let's say, an independently owned bookstore, you have the owners in charge of that space. So the books that you see either in the windows or in the aisles tend to be those selected by them because they feel those books are interesting for their audience. They know their customer base, et cetera. So it's kind of tailored to, you can see this neighborhood by neighborhood even here in New York. But if you walk into a large chain bookstore, actually what you're seeing is oftentimes books that have, whose publishers have paid a promotional fee to be featured on that table in an aisle, in that window, etc. So in point of fact, you don't have an individual's mental faculties at play there. You have the almighty dollar, to use a cliche, in play. And so what you're seeing is what has been promoted for that spot by money rather than promoted by someone's discriminating taste.
Of course, that's exactly what it is, of course. I asked, I have to go on now about Anthony Scheer. I asked him also if he thought that the U.S., as the mass publishing of the U.S., was really at the low end of the scale in Anglo-Saxonia. And he said, I don't know about that. I do know that you in the U.S. are at the very top of your unbridled enthusiasm for capitalism. It was, first of all, it was quite a pleasant shock to hear somebody use that word. He is not a long-haired radical. He's a very proper English gentleman, as you can tell from his accent, I think. Anyway, he said, if you are at the top of the scale in your enthusiasm for capitalism, and if that means that taste and seriousness have a very bad time, then you are at the bottom. But, he said very carefully, I'm not an economic historian, so I don't know. Now, the question was this, how on the scale of values do we figure not only in Anglo-Saxonia, but bring in France to say where they really have their own language to defend in the whole game?
Mm-hmm. Well, this would be very hard for me to judge from an international perspective. What I can say is there are an enormous number of wonderful books published here. I think because there are so many books published, you've got on the order of 54,000 trade books published in this country every year. What you can say is that the proportion of those is small, relatively small, as a percentage of the totality, you know, of what's published. But those are different things. In other words, if you're putting out 54,000 books, certainly 1,000 of them have to be pretty good. So while you might walk around, for instance, a couple of years ago, Howard Stern had a big book, for instance, and what you'd find is an enormous trade done in a couple of books like that that were, they may have been written by a celebrity. There may have been some other angle that promoted them. But those books do a relatively large share of the business that's outsized in proportion to their quality or importance. And then you would get a fairly high-quality novelist whose books may not sell all that many copies. There are factors that work against the huge commercial emphasis, you know, of advertising and promotion. Word of mouth is still an effective tool. There was a novel, a Civil War novel called Cold Mountain, which was a big phenomenon. Most readers will remember that a couple of years back, and that grew largely through word of mouth and by getting very positive reviews. So it wasn't the force of advertising behind it that drove it.
Right. I must admit, I thought it was sort of a middle-brow book, as mm-hmm. MacDonald used to call it.
Yeah, I did too, actually. But what I was trying to point out is that the word of mouth is what drove that book. While in the main, many trends are true, that as large chain bookstores account for a greater share of book sales now than they did, the internet is becoming a force. Independent bookstores are shrinking in terms of the percentage of sales in the total book sales. While all of those large trends are true, it is also still true that, you know, there are quality books coming out and you can find them, and word of mouth is a factor in the world.
Do you have a desperate time selecting your weekly reviews?
I do, yes. Within the context of, we get about 300 books a week in the office. Carton after carton after carton will keep coming, whether they're ordered or not. And we review about three a week. On a good week, five or six, if two or three books are bundled together in a given review. So you can see that works out to somewhere on the order of between 1% and 2% at most of the books that we see are reviewed. There is a limit on review space everywhere. You get a publication like the New York Times Book Review, they're able to be more comprehensive because they have more space, but even they are unable to treat everything. That's why some things, I'm not phobic about the influence of the internet at all, as some people are. I think when you go to Amazon and see reader reviews, for instance, keeping in mind the fact that these are statements by fans and once in a while critics of a book, and not independent criticism. But still, it's information about a book, and you can find many books there on that site, for instance, about which you can find commentary and a little bit of information when these haven't, in fact, been reviewed by any of the review media, whether they're major or minor review media. So I think eventually the internet, not to, you know, speak for Amazon.com, you know, in particular, versus any other forum, but I think the internet will develop as a good information exchange medium about books.
It is more fun to sit in a store and leaf through books than read people's.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. But at midnight on a given night, if what you feel like doing is browsing, to use the word loosely, there's no way to do it, you know, in a store that might be closed.
Right. There is this quite amazing discovery that the internet, as of now, seems to be unable to show a profit. And I wonder what do you think that means for the actual, to now talk in the terms of capitalism. Is it a good market tool?
Well, I don't. First off, I don't know if that's true. I've heard, albeit secondhand, that the actual book sales portion of Amazon, for example, shows a minor profit. I did hear Jeff Bezos, who's the head of the company, talk recently at a big book expo in Chicago, and his claim is that he's using money generated from this to expand into other lines, and you can see that if you read the headlines about them. But he also said that, online retailing is very much a scale business. That is, they need to do a very high volume, but can do it on a very low margin. And so I think that, in terms of enormous scale, is a business model that can work. Unfortunately, what it does is it's one more thing helping to decimate the numbers of small independent bookstores here. At that same book exposition, there was a group, it's called the Book Study Group, and Book Industry Study Group, and they did a study for the American Booksellers Association about, what share is held by different retail venues, and the breakdown was basically the large chain bookstores have almost a quarter of the market, and the small chains or independent bookstores have about 15%. Book clubs still have a little less than a fifth. They were about 18% of the market. And the Internet had 5.4% of all sales. Now, those are figures from 1998, so it's certainly higher now. But or they're from 99, rather. But the important thing to look at is that back in 98, which was just a year beforehand, it was 1.9% for the Internet. So the Internet sales, as a share of that market, have more than doubled, and I think it will do so again, year by year. I don't know eventually how much of a total market it could become, perhaps 10% or something. I don't think it would ever, amount to more than that. But there are also two aspects to the Internet when it comes to publishing. One is that it's a distribution mechanism. So if you order a book from BarnesandNoble.com or Amazon.com or any other online bookseller, you are ordering a book that has been printed by a publisher, and all they're doing is distributing it and taking their cut. What's coming, it's already here, actually, but it will be increasingly a part of the publishing field, is the ability to distribute the actual content, that is, the digitized book, online. And this can be done downloadable onto readers. It can be done onto your PC, and you can print it out. Or what I find, actually, is one of the exciting prospects is what's called print-on-demand publishing. Theoretically, every book can be kept in print that way. You can go to a bookstore and say, I'd like to print out this book, and they'll have the capacity to do it.
Art, have a heart. Oh, these things all give me the creeps. They're horrible. I don't share the... As a writer, I don't feel particularly romantic about the little old bookstore or the family store. I realize that it's easy to feel that way, but I found now, actually myself, that Barnes & Noble specifically does very much more to promote a book. Obviously, they can do it, but they don't seem to stick to the big bestsellers and the big blockbusters. They're quite ready to help serious books, which some of us write, or hope to write, or try to write, to promote them and read them, and have readings. So I don't think I'm stuck in some romantic past. But the electronic book, that's something else again, I think. Indeed, the other day somebody wrote in the Times, perhaps it was in the Nation, that the book as such, a soft cover book, is a perfect thing in a way, just as I think a bicycle is a perfect...
Well, I think it is. I think it is. I own several editions of various books. I mean, at one point in time, you'll get, at least three, I think, different editions of Emerson's essays, for example.
Yes.
And it's just happenstance. I may have been somewhere without the book and wanted it right then, so I got another one. It doesn't bother me in the least. I like having three different copies of it around and in a different edition, just enjoying the different typeface, the different cover, the different feel of the book. Some of them I may have underlined and I might wish to read that book again without the underlining to see if my eye picks up something else in there. So I'm a lover of the book as artifact as well.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
No, there's the idea that you have a blank book and you press a button and one text got printed and then you erase that and print another text. I don't know. It seems rather gruesome to me.
Mm-hmm. But, no, what I was talking about, actually, this print on demand is the distribution process.
Oh, no, I understand. Yes, I know. That's something not quite as far-fetched as this book where you change the text all the time. But on the other, I don't know. There, too, it has a...
Well, it's going to change as these things develop, and they will. It's going to change reading habits, I think, slightly. And reading the quote books, some quote books of the future will be kind of multimedia sorts of things.
But listen, it's hard enough to get somebody to buy a book.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so to have him order a book to be printed for him, he must really be very determined. I can see how professors would do this with whatever, but as to somebody come in and say and have a novel printed, he would have to be pretty strongly motivated, and that's not easy, man. This whole being in print, I think you'll agree with that. It's not that shocking a truth. It's nothing. Printing a book is nothing. It's the distribution where we all stumble. And that, but not because Federal Express is not fast enough, but because people just don't get to know enough what is serious and what is passing and entertainment.
Exactly.
Well, another threat to the book business, of course, or to the serious book business, which I try to make my concern here, is the fluctuating prices. If a small bookstore can't sell bestsellers because Barnes & Noble discounts them at 40%, that's very bad. And as you know, I'm sure in France, in Europe, England has gone in and out with this thing. There's this big debate about a fixed price where a bookseller obliges himself to stay within 5% of the official price as printed on the jacket. Are you in favor of that?
No, I'm not, actually. I don't see... From a retailing standpoint, in the U.S., for instance, small publishers have gone to court against... small retailers have gone to court to sue publishers in some instances when they feel that they're giving the large chain bookstores a better deal on it for anti-competitive reasons.
Yeah.
And I think that's all the leverage you need. In other words, if a publisher sells a book, gives it at the same discount to all of its customers, how those customers then turn around and resell the book is their business. So I'm not actually in favor of that fixed price myself, but we operate here in an environment where that isn't the case. So I'm coming at it from a very American perspective.
Yes, I realize it goes against the American grain to do such a thing. People feel it is an imposition on their freedom, but on the other hand, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Well, but the other thing is, many works, for instance, it's now the copyright law is now, you know, the death of the author plus 50 years. Let's say there's an awful lot of public domain work out there. So if I wanted to set up my own small press and bring out editions of Emerson, I said before, I love his essays. I own several editions of his work. Let's say I wanted to do one and price it my own way. I wouldn't wish anyone to be fixing for me a certain price, a retail price.
Of course, no, but that's not quite the same as these huge discounts on popular bestsellers. No, no, I see that. Of course, it's a much more, if that's what you're telling us, I think, that it's very much more complicated than just fixed price or not. Well, I don't know if you remember, England abolished it and now they're going back to it.
Right.
And in France, they're hanging on to it as if it was the last
the gold
thing.
Standard.
The last what's left of the French Revolution, the last triumph. Okay,
but I don't know enough about book sales in France, for example, to know. I've heard secondhand that there's much more. For instance, philosophy books do much better. So there's much more engagement with an academic world of ideas there in terms of their publishing and retail environment. I don't know how true that is. As I say, I've heard this from various people.
Well, I spent several months a year in France, and my books are being translated into French, which is makes me very proud, actually, because they're not very interested as a rule in the barbarians across the border. Mm-hmm. And I think it's true, very true what you say. They are indeed like French cooking. It's not just a myth. They are terribly literate in that sense. No French bookstore owner would have walked out like the man here did. Yes, it's quite well. They are sort of besieged now because of the language, of course, and since they have their own language, they can sort of defend themselves. I'm not romanticizing that either. We know that 80% of the films in the cinemas are American and so forth and so on. I mean, American culture, of course, has an enormous influence there. But still, the serious books live.
Well, exactly, and I've heard, for example, that Pierre Baudru, who is a philosopher and a sociologist, can be a bestseller.
Right.
There and I can't think of a time when a philosopher had a bestseller here.
Yes.
So.
Okay. One more crusade that I hope to enlist you in: public landing rights. Western Europe has taken it now as a matter of course that a writer gets a penny or about a penny, say 2 cents or whatever, for each time a book of his is lent out in a public library. It sounds very difficult, but it's very easily administered. The system is like the bestseller list in the New York Times. Each year they pick 10 libraries and they even it out. The argument being that it makes it quite a big difference to a writer. And, of course, it's a normal thing. It's a copyright matter. No musician would dream of having his stuff not copyrighted in such a way that he gets some money for each sale. I think it's from every point of view, it is a desirable thing. How do you feel about it?
Well, I think actually it makes a lot of sense. As you say, a recording artist sells a CD. Usually it's not the case that this CD is then services, let's say, 100 people. It's for use by one person in their household, you know, and the four or five others in the household. When you get to a lending library, actually one book might serve for 100 or more people. And the artist, I think, deserves some sort of payback
right.
For his or her work. Here again, the internet looms as a kind of specter over this because the question of copyright and the internet, there's an enormous question of intellectual property rights there that is unresolved because it's so easy to copy and distribute material on the internet. So I would see this, although ostensibly they're not linked, I would see them actually as linked, this idea of public lending rights from libraries as kind of linked because I think there's a loss and a coming loss on the other side.
Listen, sadly, we're running out of time because there's so much I want to ask you.
We'll do it again.
Can we have you again later
sure.
this year?
Sure.
Here's the last question. Give me a name of a book that you think has the power or had the power to change the world. That's a nation, a question in honor of the nation.
Boy, a book that has the power to change the world.
Well, say Harriet, say Uncle Tom's Cabin, for instance. In that sense, I don't mean change, set the world on his head, but had a major influence in our society as it is shaped from year to year. Can you give me another title which particularly appeals to you?
Boy. I can't. I mean, there are books that are important from various perspectives. I mean, a book that I think is enormously important, although it's largely historical, but it's important for people to think about the implications of, is a book by a Britisher, actually, Francis Stoner Saunders, and it's called The Cultural Cold War. But it basically lays out the history of the CIA funding magazines and
right.
films
yes.
and jazz concerts and everything in order to promote, it was an extremely sophisticated campaign to promote, quote, American values.
Right.
Of course, the very doing so kind of undermined the idea of American values.
Yes.
But what is scary about that book is it doesn't run up to the present day. It's history, but obviously it causes you to think, well, what similar analog might be taking place today.
Art, thank you very much.
Sure.
I'll get back to
very
you.
Very good. Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
That was Art Winslow. It was our eighth guest on this program. And next month we will have Roxanne Cody, the owner or manager of a very well-known small bookstore, R.J. Julia, in Madison, Connecticut. After that, we will play one more time the introduction because I feel not many people have heard them. And then we have a quite exciting number of people in the autumn to tell you what to think about books. And this was Hans Koning, and the producer is Scott Harris. And Ms. Cody will be heard on the fourth Thursday, that is July 27, at noon. Till then.